Hi, Eric here. We're bringing you all new episodes for the 50th anniversary of Stonewall this June, and we need your help. The Jonathan Logan Family Foundation has pledged to give us an additional $50,000 if we can raise that same amount of money from others. So we're asking for your help. Your donation will support our work to bring LGBTQ history to life through these podcasts and through our work with teachers and schools. Go to makinggayhistory.org/support to make a donation. And thanks. I'm Eric Marcus, and this is Making Gay History. In the early morning hours of June 28, 1969, I was 10 years old, sound asleep in my bunk at Camp Luema in Sussex, New Jersey. I already knew I was different, but hadn't yet put my finger on exactly why. I was a Lego nut, a big reader, a total loser when it came to team sports, and I struggled to learn how to swim. I had a girlfriend, Eva Newman, who was also 10. We looked so much alike, the same height with thick wavy brown hair and green eyes, that people thought we were twins, which didn't creep me out at all because it never occurred to me that that would be creepy. Maybe because she wasn't that kind of girlfriend. We held hands, played cards, which was about as far as I'd ever want to go with any girl. On that hot night in June 1969, asleep under a full moon in the New Jersey countryside, I was dreaming of my cat Tiger Lily, who I missed terribly. That's my story about that night 50 years ago. But while I was safely tucked into bed at Camp Luema, a rumbling of discontent was about to erupt into something much bigger, 50 miles away in New York City. There are a lot of stories about that momentous night in New York City's Greenwich Village. Stories much closer to the action than mine. Sadly, many of the people with direct experience of what happened around 1 in the morning on Saturday, June 28th at the Stonewall Inn, through that night and the nights that followed, have since died. So we've gathered almost a dozen accounts from interviews recorded in the year after the riots, from my archive from the late 1980s, and one from a more recent conversation. There are contradictions and inconsistencies in the accounts. Not everyone agrees, not everyone saw it from the same spot, memories change with time, and they rarely exactly match. But these oral histories, these personal stories, will bring this moment to life through the voices of the people who lived it. A note on language, you're going to hear the terms queen, scare drag, drag queen, and transvestite used a lot. Those words don't mean the same thing as they did back then. In some cases, they've fallen out of usage, in others, they're offensive terms now. But it's the language of the time and the people who were there, and we're here to hear their voices. It's time for me to step back and let Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, Morty Manford, Vito Russo, Craig Rodwell, Damian Martin, and Dick Leitch tell you their stories. I spoke with all of them 30 years ago, and they've all since died. You'll also hear from Martha Shelley, who is still fighting for social justice on the West Coast, from Randy Wicker, who turned 81 last February, and from Martin Boyce, who met me outside the current Stonewall Inn to tell me about its previous incarnation.
My name is Martin Boyce, and I'm a Stonewall veteran.
So we walk up to the front of the Stonewall. What was it like? You arrive at the front door. What happens next?
Well, you arrive at the front door, and then you wait for them to say, you know, either we're full or you can't come in because of this or that. That means you just weren't being allowed in. And if that didn't happen, which usually didn't happen, you would just go in. You'd pay your way. You sign the book.
Was it called the private club, the Stonewall?
The Stonewall was an illegal club. It was very mob run. I mean, it was so obviously mob. And they used it as a money drop and all kinds of stuff like that.
Right near the door was the table with the mafia guy. I mean, you know, that was pretty intimidating. I mean, you know, it was like,
first, it was just a gay men's bar, and they didn't allow no women in. And then they start allowing women in, and then they let the drag queens in. I was one of the first drag queens to go to that place.
Okay, you could get into the Stonewall if they knew you. And there were only a certain amount of drag queens that were allowed into the Stonewall at that time.
It was a slum. I mean, it was really a slum, scumbag place with the only sleazy crowd, the worst crowd of people you've ever seen in your life.
It was a very eclectic crowd, which was one of the nice things about it.
And then they had these drag queens working there. And there was just Tiffany and all this other drag queen that used to work there in the coat check room. And
so this is where I get into arguments with people. They say, oh, no, it's always a drag queen bar, and it was a black bar. No.
The place itself was pretty much of a dive. It was pretty shabby, and the glasses weren't particularly clean when they served you a drink, and they were watered-down drinks.
Stonewall didn't have any hot water. They washed their glasses in cold water, and they were spreading all kinds of diseases from one person to another.
But they had a few some lights in the back on the dance floor area, and there was a jukebox.
And it was the first place I ever seen go-go boys. Because they used to have several go-go boys that used to dance on the bar at that place.
And then you went through two swinging doors into a dance floor where people danced. And
there was another bar back there and tables where people sat. And it was just like a, you know, separate little atmosphere.
They really had a culture in there. It was really interesting and meaningful. Because here there was a group of gays that, you know, especially those scared drags who are really persecuted, really enjoying themselves as if the world were normal and not worrying that the sun will come up and not worrying about tomorrow in an amazing way. A celebration of surviving another day, living another night, maybe meeting another trick.
The Stonewall had opened its doors as a mob-run private club in March 1967, 3 years after a fire had gutted Bonnie Stonewall Inn. That was the restaurant that had occupied the space for three decades or so. The new owners of the Stonewall, affiliated with the Genovese crime family, slapped black paint on the walls to cover the fire damage, put in a jukebox, and started selling watered-down drinks and bootlegged liquor to a crowd with few other options. Private clubs like the Stonewall were being raided by the cops with increasing frequency. Those raids were usually cleared up pretty fast, with a payoff from mobster bar owners, as Sylvia Rivera explained to me.
They would come in, raid a gay bar, padlock the freaking door. The police would leave one way. The mafia was there, cunning in the door. They had a new register, they had more money, and they had more booze.
On Tuesday, June 24th, 1969, Inspector Seymour Pine from the NYPD Public Morals Division raided the Stonewall Inn. The Tuesday night raid went off like so many others. The patrons were escorted out, the bar staff were arrested, and the proceeds were confiscated. According to Stonewall historian David Carter, one of the bar's owners assured Inspector Pine that night that the Stonewall would be back up and running the next day. It was. So Seymour Pine planned another, more consequential raid that would happen a few days later.
On June 28, 1969, thousands of homosexuals rioted in New York's Greenwich Village section. The disorders began with a routine police raid on a homosexual bar, the Stonewall, on Christopher Street, in the heart of the West Village, commonly referred to as the gay ghetto of New York.
Morty Manfred was inside the bar that night.
I was inside and I was a patron.
He had no idea that two female undercover officers were already mingling with the clientele to scope things out. But he couldn't miss it when Inspector Pine and five other cops came in. According to historian David Carter's exhaustive research, the time was 1:20 a.m.
Some very officious-looking men in suits and ties entered the place. Whispers went around that the place was being raided. Suddenly, the lights were turned up, the doors were sealed, and all of the patrons were held captive until the police and the federal agents decided what they were going to do.
So you were inside?
I was inside.
And Sylvia Rivera was there that night too, apparently.
At that time, I didn't know Sylvia Rivera.
And I just happened to be there when it all jumped off. The police came in. They came in to get their payoff, as usual. It was the same people that used to always come into the Washington Square Bar to, you know, get their payoff.
It was a nervous mood that set over the place. Everybody was anxious, not knowing whether we were going to be arrested or what was happening next. Mm-hmm. We had to line up and our identification would be checked before we would be freed. People who did not have identification or people who were underage and transvestites as a whole group were being detained. And those people who didn't meet their standards were incarcerated temporarily in the coat room.
They were put in the closet.
But that's right. little did the police know the ironic symbolism of that.
Yes, yes.
But they found out fast.
I don't know if it was the customers or was the police. It just, everything clicked.
As people were released, they didn't run away and they stayed outside. They awaited the release of their friends. Some of the gays coming out of the bar would take a bow and their friends would cheer when they came out. And it was colorful thing.
This was one of the things we did. If you were not in a raid, you'd watch the aftermath. It was almost like, you know, celebrating your good luck and seeing some, like Schadenfreude, I think Germans say. It was a march of gays who had taken their chance by going to a gay bar, you know. And that's the way it was. They got caught and you didn't.
When they ushered us out, it was nice, you know, when they just very nicely put you out the door and then you're standing across the street and shouting the square bar.
Tension started to grow, and after everybody who was going to be released was released, the prisoners were herded into a paddy wagon parked right on the sidewalk in front of the bar, and they were left unguarded by the local police, and they simply walked out and left the paddy wagon to the cheer of the throng.
There's a couple of dykes they took out and threw in a car. They got out one side and...
But there was trouble between one of the drag queens in the paddy wagon and the cop outside.
Well, there's one drag queen that, you know, they brought her out and... I don't know what she said. It's just that,
And she kicked him. I only saw her heel kick him back. But that was enough for him to jump in the back of the car.
They just beat her into a bloody pulp.
You heard it. You heard it. The sounds of flesh and bone against metal. And, you know, it was a sound we all knew. We all winced.
Craig Rodwell just happened to be passing by the Stonewall with his lover, Fred Sargent, that night. Craig's account comes from an almost 50-year-old tape that we retrieved from the vault of the New York Public Library's Manuscripts and Archives Division.
And we're passing through Sheridan Square, and we noticed this big crowd from the Stonewall. There was a police van out front, and a crowd of about 500 people, I would say. And it was obvious what was going on. We asked people, they're making Stonewall and so forth. And I remember I started yelling things like, get the mafia on the bars or something. Fred punched and shut up.
He was like, Sylvia, don't go off. And I'm like, why not? I said, I have to go off. I said, I have to be part of this. I said, I have to. The feeling is here.
You saw what you want, you fags. Now get the hell out of here. Show's over. And turned around like you always turn around with complete confidence. And we started moving towards him. I mean, nobody looked at each other. Nobody discussed anything. We just started moving towards him.
Everybody's looking at each other. But why do we have to keep on constantly putting up with this?